Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.
It's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance neath the cover of October sky.
What's up, everybody? Welcome aboard to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horwich with you. And today we have a very special guest once again. It's our friend Bob Swarup from Money Mania, from Candor Global, from London, a general genius about the markets. What's up, Bob?
Hey, Todd, how you doing? Great to be back on the show.
It's great to have you. And by the way, it's Dr. Bob, not just Bob. How you doing, man?
All good. Enjoying the market volatility, enjoying all the swing around us of central bankers. It's an interesting time, as the Chinese would say.
All right, so let me ask you one question first, Bob. I say there's no volatility and that we're confusing volatility with big price swings. But big price swings, if you take the market back 30 years, it's be like an 8-point move in the market. So it's not really that big of a deal. I mean, when I look at volatility, if you measure it by the VIX, I mean, we're trading 30% lower than the 200-period moving average. What do you say?
Well, I think you know the problem you actually have is that if you think about the market since 2008, you've actually had this remarkable, 8-year period during which basically policymakers, through QE and other methods, suppressed volatility anyway. I mean, that's why, most people were trading, banks, etc. It's such a tough time. And, what you now have is you actually have a whole generation of investors and policymakers who actually have grown up in a world of zero rates and with very little volatility. So the one they see anything that's actually normal, and I would call what has happened last couple of months normal, it just spooks them, it terrifies them because they're just not used to it.
I can agree with that. And it's amazing, Bob, that, these central bankers, it appears to me, and I want to get your opinion because you are the man, that they're trying to make all the banks be socialized. What do you think?
Well, I think they're running out of options. I mean, they ran out of options actually before a while back, and now they're just digging themselves deeper and deeper. I mean, if you think about it right now, I actually almost feel sorry for them because you had a situation where the central bankers a few years ago said, you know what, guys, let's do monetary easing. They looked like it was working. Great. This is working so well that every politician now around the world says, actually, you know what, guys, you can do all the hard work in terms of monetary easing. I don't have to worry about doing anything on my side in terms of actually reforming the system or working on debt or any of the kind of stuff that's actually painful but necessary for an economy to progress and to grow. So central bankers have been carrying on monetary easing, and they carried on with it to the point where now we've entered this strange twilight world of negative interest rates. I mean, people call the zero bound a zero bound. Well, not guess what? We've gone through that. We're in negative rates. And the bizarre thing is that I think they've become so blinkered that they still believe that somehow by having negative rates, they'll force the banks to go out there and lend, they'll force people to go out there and actually spend money. It doesn't happen. I mean, the reality is you have this world now where no matter where you go in the world, everyone on a more normal level, an ordinary person on the street, is spooked. Businesses are spooked. They're terrified about what the future is. It looks uncertain. They feel that they don't really know whether this lasts or doesn't last. So what they're all doing is really retreating and retrenching until this goes away.
Well, you and I both know, I mean, you wrote Money Mania, Booms, Panics, and Busts. I mean, we know, or at least I believe, that the policies are wrong and that there is no way to avoid the cycle of bust because it always shows up. The only question here is how long do they think they can delay it before it shows up? What are your thoughts?
Well, the problem is the more you try and delay what is actually a very natural cycle, as you said, the worse it becomes. If you look at the difference between, say, a recession and depression, a depression is probably a recession that went on for way too long and you end up with a depression. It's the problem. If you had a normal cycle, we'd have had a little bit of letting off of steam, markets would have corrected, people would have gotten back to normal. We'd have cleansed out some of the zombie companies, we'd have cleansed out some of the bad debts, and we reset. What you have right now is because people refuse to let the bad time come, they keep trying to perpetuate the good time, which actually is an anomaly. That's not the way it happens. I mean, you know, if you think about it, right, we breathe in, we breathe out. You try to keep a breath in, you're just going to choke to death. That's the way it works. And that's kind of what's happening in the financial economy right now. And you have a problem now where I suspect the problem has become so much worse for this, for the fact that they've been trying so hard to keep it, that I think it's terrifying. When you look at global debt, you know, bear in mind this all began in 2007 with debt, right? So since 2008 to now, global debt is actually up by 50%, okay? So, you know, we haven't gone away from the problem of 2008. We've actually just made it much worse. So now, when that debt comes back to bite somebody in the nether regions, as it were, it's going to be a lot more painful. And this time, there's a lot less room to maneuver. So China is one example, sure. But by the way, you know, Puerto Rico or Greece and the Atlantic, if I would like to think of it, is another example. You know, you go look at, for example, student loans. You go look at, you know, some of the sort of debt in sovereign Europe. I mean, those are all examples of actually unsustainable debt burden, an unsustainable amount of debt, which needs to be badly restructured, but no one has the guts right now to go out there and restructure this debt.
Well, we as you're talking about this, I wrote about quite a while ago, but auto and student loan debt is surpassed the $2 trillion mark, which is twice as big as what the housing market bubble was.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, this is the thing. I mean, you know, in the economy, ultimately, if you look at debt, debt has a role to play in the economy. It helps us to fund growth because we basically borrow from the future. But the reality is you borrow this money because you hope that by borrowing this money, you're going to get much more growth. You accelerate that growth. The problem is that you get too much debt, it starts to work against you. And the utility of every dollar of debt you take on goes down and down the more you take out. And I think we must be in negative territory now, because we have a situation right now where we're just borrowing more and more, almost to stand still. And, you know, the private sector, to some extent, may have deleveraged in the U.S., for example, in terms of housing debt a bit. But the government then steps in to pick up the slack. And, you know, I think the problem is, unless you actually do anything about that, you have a situation where there's too much debt in the system, this is saturated, and therefore there is no growth left in there, no organic growth. And, you know, I think a lot of people on the gut level get that. I mean, this is why you have this strange anomaly where a policymaker will tell you, you know, they're blue in the face that the economy is growing, the economy is growing, the economy is growing. But anybody who's actually in the markets, anybody who's actually got a job, sits there and feels that somehow this is all wrong, that somehow this doesn't feel normal to them. But actually, they're just sitting there waiting for something to hit the fan.
Well, and you and I both know it's going to hit the fan, because that's the way that they created. And I want to talk about the Fed more in depth, not before we come up against a break, but they created this mess. And this is, I mean, I don't know how you look at it, but this is going to be a horrible mess. And they've really wiped out a lot of people as well in their wake of trying to do what they think is the right thing, which I don't agree. And you and I'll talk about this as well. But they have wiped out a lot of people in the meanwhile, haven't they?
Well, I mean, they've had a lot of unintended consequences. I mean, they wiped out people, as you said, but also bear in mind that all the new regulation that's come in, all this attempt at financial stability, actually has also created lots and lots of restrictions on actually normal functioning utilities, one might say, in the financial world. So a bank, actually, you know, yes, they should have done all the kind of prop trading they were doing, perhaps, and all the rest of it, but actually banks are finding it very, very hard now to fulfill their most basic functions of making markets. So, you know, you take something like fixed income, which is pretty vital to the debt markets, which is pretty vital to most of the global economy, much larger than equity markets. Fixed income liquidity has dropped since 2008 by probably about 70%, right?
Well, that's not a good thing. Hold that thought. We're going to come back and finish up with the fixed income, because that's only the biggest market in the world by 7 or 8 times. We're visiting with Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, as well as the author of Money Mania, Booms, Panics, and Busts. And this guy's got it down. We haven't gotten into to what kind of economist he is yet, but we'll get there. We'll come back and talk about fixed income and other things. This is The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. Make sure, if you ever miss an episode, every day they're posted for you at libertytalk.fm on demand. We now have, we just surpassed the 200,000 downloads per month, and I want you to be one of them. This is The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. We'll be right back with Dr. Bob after the break. The Bubba Show.
Tonight.
Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz with my friend, Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, also author of Money Mania, Booms and Busts, and all kinds of crazy stuff in the economy. He does understand it. He does have it. So, Bob, we went through and we were talking about fixed income and the big problem, because I believe that through this fixed income market, that they are herding everybody, not herding, but herding like cattle into the equity markets, because there is no fixed income market right now, because there's nowhere to go for yield. And that will create even a bigger problem. So go ahead and finish your thoughts, sir, please.
Well, I think what they've done is, you're right, it's not that we're just herding into the equity market, they're actually herding into anywhere where they can get some additional yield or return. So, you know, if you look at, for example, the emerging markets crisis that's playing out right now, a large part of that is because a lot of the capital that couldn't make any money in investment-grade credit in the U.S. and Europe ran into emerging market debt, to the extent where loads of emerging market countries, because of the bonanza time for the last few years, were issuing hand over fist lots of debt in U.S. dollars. Guess what? That's a carry trade of a different sort. You know, as that currency starts to weaken against the U.S. dollar, they're all going to end up in trouble. And that's what we're seeing right now. These same guys, by the way, you know, have gone hand over fist into areas like direct lending. So this is where effectively you've had lots and lots of these private debt funds set up, who've now taken over from the banks in supplying debt for all the leverage buyouts in the U.S. and in Europe and so on. And, you know, the thing is that, look, a system will always generate debt if there's a demand for it, and there is a huge demand for it, because you have large pockets of capital, the pension funds and the insurance companies and others like that, who desperately need return. And if they can't get it in, within quotes, more normal markets, they just move further and further along the credit curve. When they reach the end of that curve, they try and find something new to get into. And the problem is that at the same time, you have this issue where the banks themselves are retreating from large parts of what would have been typical banking activities. I mean, you know, for example, in Europe, if you look at areas like, you know, NPLs, you look at receivables, you look at commodity trade finance, I mean, pretty core functions for bank, you know, they're retreating from that. In fact, if anything, the convergence between bank and sovereign is enormous now. I mean, there is very little difference between the two, and you can see that, by the way, if you were to look at the CDS, for example, for, say, I don't know, say, UniCredito Bank in Italy and the Italian government, they're not very far apart. It tells you that actually, as far as these banks are concerned, they've almost been emasculated, and they've become really just an extension of the sovereign balance sheet. That has a huge impact on global trade. It has a huge impact on the flow of capital and the flow of liquidity. And these are all important parts of a functioning economy. If you don't have these things, if you don't have the ability to trade, well, guess what? You know, an economy just withers and dies, because an economy, by definition, is not a static thing. It is not something in equilibrium. It is something that is actually in constant disequilibrium. It is constantly moving, changing, transacting. And if it does not transact, it dies. Unfortunately, what we have right now globally is an economy that is transacting less and less and less. That is dangerous.
So I say that the Fed, the central banks, have overstepped their bounds in their policies, and I say that in the United States, since Greenspan, all we've had is a bunch of Fed chairs that know how to create bubbles but have no idea how to get out. What do you say?
Well, I think the mistake is that, you know, I guess everyone loves having people they can put their faith in. They love being told what their answer is. And you know, the way I kind of look at the central banking community in general, and don't get me wrong, these are very smart people in their own right, and there is, you know, a lot of good stuff they do as well. But the reality is, these guys have become modern day witch doctors, right? They're the shamans of the tribe, right? You go there, you tell them all your troubles, they brew the magic potion, bubble, bubble, toil and trouble, and hey, presto, here's the answer to all of your monetary woes. That is the problem. You know, every policymaker I know lives and dies by GDP, for example. GDP up, GDP down, inflation up, inflation down. They don't actually question their assumptions. They don't question perhaps whether what they're doing is working or not. And what I find, which is awful also, is that nobody is questioning them either. You know, people in the media don't, I think, enough. Policymakers themselves don't. And the lack of diversity of opinion is actually bad. And, you know, if you look at any society that functions well, it's one where you have different opinions. You know, you need different opinions. That's kind of what good debate is about. And there is a very huge lack of debate. I mean, the biggest bubble you have today, by the way, is not one of equity markets or bond markets, the biggest bubble today is actually the bubble of central bank omniscience. There's this notion that somehow we can believe that the future can be predicted by these guys. I mean, that's laughable. In fact, central banks for many, many hundreds of years, and they existed before, always stayed away from trying to predict the future because they knew you cannot forecast the future. And as J.K. Galbraith said, the only point of forecasting is to make astrology look respectable.
Well, you know, again, and I don't want to put words in Dr. Bob's mouth. I'm the guy who says the Fed are very smart people. Obviously, they went to MIT, they went to Princeton. They're all extremely bright when it comes to reading theory and looking at a book. But in my opinion, this is Bubba's opinion only. They have no common sense. Okay, they can't figure out the basics of having to react on their feet. And I think that all of them, when they started getting involved in investing in assets, now that China owns, the government owns 52 or 53% of their markets, I think that's totally out of line and wrong. And I think when Draghi went in to start buying some stuff himself, I think that's out of line. And I think that's way above the bounds. But of course, you guys over there have had central banks for hundreds of years. We've only had them for 108, and I wish we didn't have them anymore. What do you think?
Well, I mean, you're right. It's just so much of this whole idea that liquidity is drained out of many markets. It's because you've got the central banks as far too large a part of it now. I mean, you know, you look at some of the issues of gilts in the UK. I mean, the Bank of England probably owns more of them than the rest of the market. So that doesn't help. I mean, it kills liquidity, as I said earlier. And it also just distorts pricing. I mean, you know, you are living in a world right now where the pricing mechanism is broken down. I mean, if you think about it this way, if I give you the balance sheet of Apple today, right, and I told you, tell me what the share price of Apple is, you know, you actually can't tell me that anymore. And the reality is, you know, when you look at a balance sheet and look at all the profit, the loss, the receivables, the income, etc., you're going to put in there a bunch of assumptions about multiples, about rates of growth, etc. And that's how you work out, at least as an analyst, what you think the stock price of Apple should be. Every single assumption you make is something that's based on a perception of what in quotes normal markets. When you're in this twilight zone so far away from it, actually the fundamentals are meaningless. The price could be anything you want it to be, because it doesn't exist. So this is an artificial suppression of the pricing mechanism. And that's dangerous because, you know, when you look at the market, if you don't know what the pricing mechanism is, well, guess what? Either you just say a bit like, you know, Chuck Burns said that I'm just going to sit there and dance till the game finishes at musical chairs, or you withdraw from the market. And I think the worrying thing for me is that a lot of people, I think, are slowly withdrawing from the market bit by bit because they just can't anymore.
Well, you know, I think that that's great, and you're correct, and I've said and I've written about that they have taken away free markets and true price discovery away from the markets themselves, which don't allow asset classes to price themselves, and I think you agree with that, yes?
No, I agree. I think there's a problem. The price discovery mechanism is broken. And I think, you know, if you look around, you look at a lot of trading funds. I mean, they're all slowly going bust. I mean, the hedge fund community, by and large, has a pretty bleak future at the moment in the current environment. And, you know, the tragedy of that is that, you know, while they might be going up in flames, you've got all the, you know, people on the left saying they're saying this is fantastic, you know, burn the bankers or whatever. But what they're forgetting entirely is that if you don't have two sides to a trade doesn't exist. If you don't have other people in there who are providing, in effect, the volatility we talked about earlier, i.e. the volatility of normal times, then, you know, there isn't an economy. You know, a trade needs two people. One person has to believe they're getting a better deal than the other. But if you don't allow them to feel that, if they don't allow them to feel that they understand the pricing, well, guess what? They just won't bother trading. And I think that's terrible. I think you know, what they don't appreciate is that they're actually hollowing out the economy from within. And what you're going to end up with is really economy that is going to become increasingly dictated more and more by the state. And, well, we've all seen where that ends up. It never ends up in a good place. It's certainly not a prosperous one.
Well, you could tell us all the good news about the South Sea bubble that broke Sir Isaac Newton. I mean, they just paid that final debt payment back from 1730, I think, about 6 or 7 months ago. But we're hanging out today. We got you see how he is, this man, Dr. Bob. He just tells it like it is. He doesn't care. He's right up there. He agrees with some of stuff I say. He doesn't agree with others, but that's what makes a trade, good and bad. You got to have a buyer and a seller to make a trade, and that's what they call price discovery. But we're with Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, also the author of Money Mania, panics, booms, and busts, or booms, busts, and panics. I always forget. I get the title screwed up, but it's there. It's on Amazon. Check it out. This is the Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. We're going to step out here for a break, but before we do, just make sure you check out our partners at Thinkorswim, built by traders for traders. They offer swim lessons every day. Yours free if you're an account holder there. And in the meantime, we're with Dr. Bob Swarup from Candor Global. This is the Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. We will step out here for a break, but make sure to download every day LibertyTalk.fm. The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz will be right back. Dr. Bob Swarup.
Trust. For nearly four decades, that is the reputation Roberts & Roberts Brokerage has forged with their customers. Now, with their full e-commerce website, rrbi.co, it's easier than ever to buy or sell precious metals via Bitcoin or major credit card. Visit them online at rrbi.co or call 800-874-9760 to speak with an experienced professional today. Roberts & Roberts, when you're serious about precious metals.
What's up, everybody? Bubba here. It's finally here, the long-awaited Bubba Report, bringing you news from all the trading floors across the globe. We've got Scott Cialady, the cow guy, as seen on CNBC, Fox, and Bloomberg. We've got Keith Bliss, CNBC, Fox, and a floor trader at the New York Stock Exchange. We've got the Badger, who writes the hot topics in the political news. We've got myself putting together my own unique indexes that will help you give you a better idea of what's going on in the market. All you need to do to get a hold of the Bubba Report is go to thebubbashow.org and sign up for the newsletter, or you can email me direct at bubba@thebubbashow.org. We want you to have this report because we've got over 150 years of experience talking about markets, getting ready for the trading, and puts you in the best position to have successful. So email me at bubba@thebubbashow.org to get a copy of your report, or go right to the website, thebubbashow.org. Make sure you get it. It's a must-have for every investor and trader. The Bubba Report. Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz with my friend, Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global, as well as the author of Money Mania, Booms, Panics, and Busts. So, Dr. Bob, tell us, explain to everybody about Brexit. That's the big talk now. Brexit. Explain it to everybody, will you please, sir?
Sure. Well, I mean, Brexit, of course, is what dominates all the headlines out here now, which is the fact that on the 23rd of June, the United Kingdom is going to go to this referendum to decide if it wants to stay in the European Union or leave the European Union. And it's become a big issue. And I think, you know, the current Prime Minister, David Cameron, promised this as an election tactic to get himself elected. And I think at the time, at least, to pacify the more right-wing part of his Conservative Party. Unfortunately, I think it's really come back to haunt him, because with all the stuff that's happening in Europe, beyond, you know, all the Greek crisis and the migrant issues, but also the tensions within Britain and Europe, it actually looks like this referendum is going to be a very close-run thing. I mean, there is actually, I mean, certainly an emotional gut kind of reaction. A lot of people are anti the Eurozone now. And so there is actually a good possibility that come the 23rd of June, the British might vote to leave Europe, which if they do, is going to put everyone into a completely different twilight zone, which they've never been there before. I mean, no country's ever left the Eurozone before. It hasn't happened. And although a lot of the talk out here has focused on about how terrible it would be for Britain if it leaves, how, you know, Britain must not give up its place, and even, you know, you've got people like Obama putting pressure, for example, on the British not to vote yes. What I think is actually more interesting to me is that I suspect that if Britain votes to leave the Eurozone, that starts to create the death spiral of the Eurozone. Because it's that first chink, it's that first country leaving, at which point all the other countries suddenly now have a process that can be followed to all exit one by one.
Are you a believer? Now, doesn't Britain still have the pound sterling as well, though?
They have the pound sterling, they've got the Bank of England, they've got their own central bank. But don't forget, I mean, the reason why the British chafe about Europe a lot is because, firstly, I mean, I think historically over the last few hundreds of years, the British and the continental Europeans never exactly been the best of pals, right?
Right.
They've fought enough wars, they've never liked each other. So you know, this was never something that was going to be a marriage, that's for sure. It was meant to be a free trade agreement in the 1970s. And unfortunately, what happened is, I think for the British, they still wanted to be a free trade agreement and nothing more. for the rest of Europe, because this really was ultimately a political mechanism to prevent another world war, you know, it became more and more a vehicle for political union as they saw it. So if you look at the French and the Germans and a lot of the countries within continental Europe, they've been getting closer and closer together, you know, devolving more and more powers up to Brussels. So you have this whole superstate slowly emerging, by the way, not entirely with the sort of, you know, buy-in of all of its citizens. The British don't really want that. And that's the fundamental tension in British and Europe. Now, when it was Britain in good times and the US in good times, that was just, you know, a little bit of a fight. In the current environment, where you actually have economic tensions, social tensions, political tensions, this starts to become quite a toxic battle.
So, let me ask you this, Dr. Bob. Are you a fan of the fiat currency system, or are you a fan of the of having currency backed by something other than the central bankers that can flip it around and print it anytime they want?
Well, you see, I don't think you ever can get currency that's backed by something. Because, you know, I'll tell you, I think if you have anything called currency, there's always a way of playing around with it. And I'll give you an example, which is, I mean, let's take gold, which, of course, a lot of people talk about having currency backed by gold. I mean, pretty much any time you've had a gold-backed currency, it still has always been a fractional reserving system. And the best example of that even today is, you know, if you go look around and all the people who go out and buy, unless they actually buy physical gold they actually own, when they're sitting there buying bullion sitting in some vault somewhere, or they're buying, you know, ETFs, etc., more often than not, there is, you know, somebody moving gold from one corner of the room to another corner of the room in another vault somewhere else, and that's supposed to be your lot of gold. So if anyone had actually went up there and said, I want all my gold at once, they would have the same problem as the run on the bank. I think human nature, unfortunately, is such that the moment we invent currency, we very, very quickly leverage it up. It's just the way we handle it. It's very hard for us. I think the danger we've run into right now is that we've removed any lever, however, to enforce any kind of honesty. I mean, the one nice thing about having a gold-backed currency was that even though it was still a fiat system in its own way, as I said, with fractional reserving, the one thing it did was it gave everyone at least a yardstick by which if you started to get too far away, other people could get spooked and start to run away from you. And that kept you reasonably honest. And in this new zone where, you know, you can pretty much make it out as you go along, I think it's very hard. You know, the pricing mechanism even in the currency world disappears, right, as we discuss.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree with that as well. I mean, I've always been kind of straddled the fence, but now we have, you know, Bitcoin. What is your feel? What is your take of Bitcoin? Does it have a chance to be a legitimate currency, or is this just an invention?
Look, I think the thing with Bitcoin is, and I've written about this before, and Bitcoin, I think, is a fascinating experiment. It, by the way, proves that anything can be money, and that Bitcoin is not the first innovative thing that ever came out. To give you a simple example, and let's go back, you know, nearly 1,000 years to the 1100s. Back then, the British at some point actually ran out of silver, you know, and they didn't know what to do. And the king at the time, Henry, decreed that going forward, the government would take payment in the form of wooden sticks. And so he decreed, it was very simple, it was a stick. You know, you would make notches on it that represented, you know, the amount of money you owed. You would then cleave the stick in two, and the debtor would get one, the creditor would get the other. And, you know, of course, you could carry on transactions because you put the two sticks together. You know, so these things were called tallies. And it actually, by the way, because the government legitimized it by saying they would take taxes in the form of these sticks actually then became currency in Britain, and they survived as currency in Britain, valid legal currency in Britain, for 700 years. Wow. In fact, I mean, even as late as the 1800s, they were still technically legal tender. And the Bank of England had the most enormous amount of these, and they were then stored in the Houses of Parliament. And in fact, at some point, they decided to get rid of them all in, I think, 1836. So they put them all into a big furnace in the basement of the Houses of Parliament and unfortunately burnt the whole Parliament down.
Well, that's what the sticks are for, to burn.
Well, it's, you know, the first time money literally brought the house down, right?
You know, so I mean, here's my thought is that I don't care what they use as currency. I just want it backed by an exchange. I don't want it backed by the Fed. I don't want anybody having control of it. I just want, like, for example, you know, the Forex market and the currency market from the CME. I mean, I don't like the Forex because all those firms are not necessarily insured against who's you're trading against. And at the CME, I know that my money is guaranteed if I make a trade there. So I just want somebody to be a guarantor of the money. I don't want somebody to be able to manipulate the money. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I agree. And I think this is the point. It's all about price discovery. You know, you want to be able to value your currency versus other currencies and to understand where they're at. And you want to understand that the system actually has some honesty or integrity attached to it. I mean, if you look at it, you know, one of the interesting debates that now started up, which is a dangerous one, is this notion of, you know, should we be moving towards a cashless society? And you actually have some countries like Sweden, I believe, that actually wants to move to an entirely digital economy where they actually almost ban cash. And that's very, very dangerous, because you think about that for a second. What you do is you actually create what you may call a central bank police state, because in that scenario, whoever your monetary authority is now actually has complete control over all the levers that define money. So people, if they feel the money is worthless, well, how will they express that view? They can't. You know, it's not like they can hold cash. It's not like they can choose to go into different, you know, currency, etc. And Bitcoin, from that perspective, starts to become interesting in that it actually has a completely different basis to it, because it's something that is not state-backed, and therefore it may represent a different store of value that they believe that enough other people believe it, because it is ultimately also still a Ponzi scheme in its own right. The only problem Bitcoin has, though, is that for Bitcoin to really take off, companies would have to use it. You would have to be able to feel that Bitcoin is very, very transferable for your everyday transactions, because that's what most people are driven by. And that never happens unless a government on some level legitimizes it by saying, we'll accept tax payments in this form, or we'll allow transactions in this form on exchanges or things like that. When you do that, then suddenly it takes a life of its own.
Well, I mean, I actually accept Bitcoin on my system, and, you know, Priceline and Overstock.com and a lot of hotels are accepting Bitcoin. And again, I accept it because, you know, a lot of the people that listen to me are use it. So I believe, you know, I'm not a big believer in it. But, you know, all I do, of course, is I've got a clearing agent that the minute it hits, I turn it back into dollars. But I do think that, you know, people are going to use it. And unfortunately, I think also in the Bitcoin environment that a lot of that money goes to people that are trying to hide money. Maybe they're, you know, we talk about the good guys and the bad guys, but, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell which is which. But if you're dealing in a lot of transactions are maybe not necessarily legal, that'd be a good way to hold your money as well. But, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, it looks to be fairly viable as a source. I mean, in fact, I know Macy's takes it as well in the States here. But, you know, we'll talk more about this right after the break. We got Dr. Bob Swarup, Money Mania at Amazon. You got to buy this book. Listen to this guy. You hear what he talks about? He's almost talks like me, but he's much more professional about it. So it's great to have him. Dr. Bob Swarup, Candor Global. This is the Bubba Show. Make sure you don't miss a show. You got to download it at libertytalk.fm, and you can have Dr. Bob with us. He'll be there because you're going to want to listen back to this one again, because he's telling you probably what's going to happen in the near future. This is The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. We will be right back after the break. The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. Welcome back to The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz with Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, as well as the author of Money Mania, Booms, Panics, and Busts. He's the guy. He's got it. He understands it. And he's been involved in these central bankers since his whole life. And it's been there. How long have there been central banks in Europe?
Well, the Bank of England was, let me see, in the 1690s it was first set up. So it's been around for a while.
500 years.
But when the first set up, they were actually a private bank.
So, Dr. Bob, last on the Fed, because I actually want to get your thoughts going forward. But now, the Fed really creates money out of air, and the whole banking theory is to have people borrow money and never pay it back, but just pay the interest payments so they can keep getting the income from the interest payments. And of course now, because of all the dumb regulations that we have now, have banks don't want to lend money because it's too hard and there's not a big enough spread because the interest rates are too low. But basically what the Fed is really doing is they're just devaluing our currency and building up more into the wealthy's pockets. Am I wrong or am I right or am I nuts? Well, I'm nuts, but besides it.
No, I think you're right. I think a lot of the way policy has evolved is probably actually, I mean, it's interesting. People talk a lot about inequality and, you know, this notion that inequality has grown a lot. And actually, I think monetary policy in recent years has fueled a lot more of it. Because if you think about GDP, you know, I was saying earlier, we never really question the assumptions. So if you look at GDP, so let's pretend you and I go out tonight, we have a wild party, we blow a few $1,000 drinking bottles of Cristal. That's great. It's a fun night out. You know, on the other hand, let's take that same few $1,000 and invest in a factory or something. Still the same amount of money, but you know and I know in real terms that money will produce a much better return to society, to the economy, and to us over the next few years, hopefully. The point is, as far as GDP is concerned, both are identical. There is no difference between the two. And so when you think about that, what it tells you is that at least the assumptions that we've just taken to heart and accepted without questioning are ones that actually tell you that, you know, consumption is as good as investing. It makes no difference really which one you do, which is one of the reasons why, if you look at the rather naive response to every crisis in recent years, it's always been, well, we must get consumers to consume more. We must get people to consume more. We must get more debt in the system. And that's terrible, because actually what you're doing is you're hollowing this mouth from within, because you're not actually investing. And there is a fundamental difference between consumption and investment. Both are important, but both need to also happen. And if you don't make that distinction, then you will end up with that. That's one problem. The second problem you also have is if you go down the route of more and more debt, if you think about it this way, if you have a society where everyone is consuming anyway, you consume all your income, you're then really letting off your savings and the interest or the investment income you make in your savings. If you're rich, guess what? Every year, you're probably never going to consume everything you actually make, and your savings will go up more and more every year. If you're, on the other hand, lower down in the socioeconomic ladder, your savings are less, you are consuming more and more, you will never go up as much. But just without doing anything, without any malice, that gap between rich and poor keeps growing. Now, if you throw debt in there, well, guess what? Who are the people going to buy debt? The people who own debt or buy debt are always going to be the people who are wealthy in society. And if you look over time, what debt will become eventually, if you have too much of it, is a gradual transfer of interest payments from many people to a fewer people. So again, over time, you feel inequality. So if you look at what the Fed's done, and if you look at what most governments have done as a result, is in this effort to run around, you know, trying to create this society of consumers, they actually, I think, fuel inequality far more. And they also create ultimately a far more fragile economy that, when booms and busts come along, as inevitably do, finds the whole thing far more terrifying and far more painful than it might otherwise.
Okay, Dr. Bob. Now, I want to get your view of the upcoming year, next couple of years. What do you see coming in the next, you know, whatever? I mean, obviously, we can never time the market. You and I both know that that's impossible, but we have a general clue of what we think may happen. What are you looking for in the next year or two, and then what are you looking for down in the future?
Well, I think the market volatility you had in the first 2 or 3 months was the market for the first time starting to challenge this notion of central bank omniscience. I think the market will get sedated at the moment, simply because you've got Draghi in Europe coming out with, you know, more and more negative rates, increasing QE. The Japanese are going further down that path. And even the Fed has now started to take its foot off the pedal and backtrack a bit. I think, however, next year, you know, what you end up with is a situation where, as these tensions in the system build up more and more, you know, the problem is, by trying to avoid the problem, it only becomes worse and worse. And at some point, no matter what you do, you can't avoid it. And I think as these tensions start to come out, you are going to have the situation where at some point, central bank credibility just starts to go. And that, I think, we're reaching the point on that. I don't think it happens this year. I think it probably happens next year. But I don't think we're that far away. We also have the problem that every economy still has a cycle, whether you choose the president or not. We are now 9 years since the last crisis began. They happen on average once a decade. You know, we're kind of round about due another one anyway. So, and, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, something that's already in the system. I mean, you've got plenty of catalysts out there, right? I mean, for example, if Brexit happens, that's going to create uncertainty in the UK and Europe. If the migrant crisis gets any worse, that's going to create uncertainty. So you've got so many catalysts now that are emerging that I just think it's inevitable, a matter of time for one of them dents confidence enough that people start panicking again.
And panic they will, and of course that is really what drives the market is fear and greed. That's all. Listen, as long as there's a human emotion involved, the markets are always be driven. And I think, unfortunately, that A, we've piled a number of elderly that do not want to be in the market whatsoever, but they're there because they don't want to spend all their savings, as you just went through so nicely, because they're not going to be able to live without spending it because they're not churning enough. They're not getting enough yield on their money. And you've got the people now, the greedy factor, where we have margin debt at record highs, okay, because money is cheap and people are leveraging up their position, which can only lead to ugliness at some point. Telling you when that is, who knows? I mean, you know, we look at, in 6 weeks, we went from all kinds of fear to now we're back, you know, running like the markets, like there's never any problem. And that's something that I think the average guy doesn't understand, Bob, is that markets change and the technicals will give you a better clue of what's going to happen. But the fundamentals haven't changed in the last 6 weeks, have they?
No, the market's back on monetary methadone right now. And so it's sedated again, right? Well, unfortunately, it only lasts for so long. I mean, the other two trends I'd probably highlight, which I think are going to be quite important in the coming years, although they're a bit slower moving. One is this notion I talked about, how banks are becoming more and more tied to sovereigns. You know, as these credit links degrade, bear in mind, that eventually will slowly lead to, effectively, a deglobalization that starts to occur. Because, you know, countries become slightly more inward-looking. If you look at the domestic politics, by the way, of most countries, U.S., Europe, elsewhere, they're starting now to become also more inward-looking. They're less worried about the rest of the world. They're more concerned about inside. And that will all slowly come through, unfortunately, in the weakening of economic links. And the second one I'd point out, I think it's going to be a huge trend for the next few years, and I think it's a direct result, by the way, of this growing obsession with inequality, but also this problem where you don't have an actual growing economy, is, you know, people have started talking a little bit about the rise of robots and so on, and I think this clash of technology and toys is going to be huge, because wage growth sucks. You know, jobs are still crap, you know, and you have so much weakness in the economy that most countries, and you look at the Bernie Sanders of the world, you look at any of the left wing and the right wing, by the way, both sides of the political spectrum are now obsessed with jobs. They're obsessed with preserving jobs one way or the other. And so what it means is that if you now start to have technology, which historically has always been disruptive but ultimately good for productivity, the problem is every time technology comes along, you know, the first last revolution, second last revolution, yes, it gave you huge growth, but for 10 to 20 years, it destroyed a load of jobs, and there's a huge move of people from one sector to another. And that kind of disruption in this environment, no politician wants, and no society, I suspect, will want to accept it either. So my suspicion is that what you'll start seeing, and this is unfortunate, it's a prediction I'm making, which I wish I didn't have to, is that I think you'll start to see a growing rise in labor protections. And I think you see it already, for example, in this move towards minimum wage, which has now acquired shades of morality. So, for example, you have this concept in the UK of what they call a living wage. You know, you have this fact that, for example, things like tax have now started to have moral dimensions attached to them. Well, it's the rise of what I would call economic patriotism. You know, and that's dangerous because what you really have is, you can call it patriotism, but actually it's protectionism.
It's very dangerous. I got to cut you off. We're done. This is Dr. Bob Swarup, Candor Global. I finally got him to use the word sucks, and I got to say goodbye now. Candor Global, Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts. Bob, thank you so much.
No worries, sir.
This is the Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horace. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Same time, same station. Have a great night, everybody. Thank you so much. We'll see you later. I got a feeling.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.